Hi there, I'm Alex Usher, and this is Higher Education Strategy Associates, one podcast to start your day.
It starts off with this very high-tech syntho-sequency type thing, like this. That's the news. And the strings take the melody.
Good morning, and this is the inaugural edition of One Podcast to Start Your Day. This is our new experiment in cross-media posting, and the topic of today's podcast is going to be strategic enrollment management in Canada. And with me to discuss this today are Melissa Padfield, who is University of Alberta's Deputy Provost of Students and Enrollment. Melissa, hi.
Hi, nice to be here, Alex.
Darren Fernandez, who's the Assistant Vice Provost and University Registrar at York University here in Toronto.
Hello, thanks for having me.
And all the way from Vancouver is Jonathan McQuarrie, who's Higher Education Strategy Associates Director of Academic Planning.
Hi, Alex. Good to be here.
Thanks, everybody. Really glad you could be with us. Hope you will sit through the bumps of this inaugural podcast as we try to nail down the format a little bit. Basically, I'm the convivial host. I'm going to be passing off a few questions to our panelists, and hopefully they will get in it with a minimum of, as I'm told, bullshit and a maximum of deep, piquant pieces of interesting banter. So let me just start off, Darren, with you. I guess I'm going to ask the question about strategic enrollment management. This is a practice that started in the United States 30 or 40 years ago. Eventually, it came up to Canada. What's your understanding of strategic enrollment management? What can you tell the folks at home, so to speak?
I think of it, or the easiest way for me to think of it is a visual diagram, which I'm going to try and paint out maybe via this podcast. So through looking at the student spectrum in many ways. So if we think of it everything from what we're doing to position our institution at the outset of the spectrum to get students interested in the process, different than the funnel that we might be really commonly familiar with. What happens when they actually become curious and interested in the university through all those different elements. But the real thing that I think sometimes gets maybe lost or there's not a lot of attention to around strategic enrollment management or SEM is that middle bit of what happens once they actually come to our institution and what we need to do to keep them here and keep them engaged and ensure that they remain connected to the institution in a deeper way. Ultimately, hopefully, having them graduate and become successful alumni of the university and then potentially seeing them back start at the funnel again or at the start of the continuum again. So I see SEM to be inclusive of all those pieces. And I think there's been a bit of a history to focus typically at the front end of that piece and that being a lot where the energy goes. But I think over time, both, you know, colleagues in the States and here in Canada have evolved to see it span and have a greater focus on that middle bit of what it means to ensure that students remain engaged through various means, you know, outside of the classroom activity as much as inside. When I say outside, I mean co-curricular education, experiential learning, that sort of stuff.
Interesting. Melissa, let me ask you a question, because I think, you know, this does come from the United States. I've mentioned that, Darren's mentioned that. The United States is a much more competitive market. And I don't mean that they're better institutions. I just mean there's a lot more of them, and so they're fighting for position. And in a lot of cases, they don't necessarily have the same base of public funding to fall back on. I can say that to someone in Alberta. I can't say it to someone in Ontario, but you know what I mean. This is they usually have a little bit more to back them up. So it's a little more existential for American institutions, is my take on it. I mean, what's your take on the difference between how SEM is practiced here and in the US?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think existential is the right way to put it when we talk about what it was in the States, although we tend to lag around these ideas, usually about 10 or 15 years behind some of the ones that catch on, and then we steal the practices that we think work for our context, and then we make them Canadianized, right? So when you talk about this is a way to achieve financial sustainability for a lot of US universities, I mean, let's get real about that. That's what they're doing it for. For us, there's an element to that? I mean, there has to be, right? We're talking about, for me, when I think STEM, I think of the activation of our mission through planful approaches to student enrollment management and class creation, right? So insofar as there's a sustainability aspect to that, which there always has to be, can you afford to offer the programs you need to offer in the balance of where your funding comes from? That's just smart, because the student experience isn't going to be managed in a positive way if you can't afford the programs that you're giving. That said, I think we take a little bit more of that holistic view to it that Darren was talking about. So in Canada, I think we really are talking about class building for the purpose of learning community, right? That's the starting point, and developing a learning community. Now, are we agnostic to the fact that we have financial realities that have to be managed through our enrollment? No. I mean, absolutely not. But I think there is a lot more conversation about the student experience and a learner-centered enrollment management that we are able to engage in because we do have sort of a different funding relationship in some ways. I think that we hear a lot of the same conversations around access in the SEM discussion that happened in the US as here. One of the things I think we covet about the SEM discussion in the US is their data and the way in which they can get, I would love a National Student Clearinghouse level data for Canada to be able to really understand student demographics differently than we can right now. And I think you'll see that evolution continuing on. I know stuff's happening with UAC and OCAS around data in common applications. And I think the same will happen in Alberta as well. But I think we have the luxury of a broader view of SEM in some cases because we haven't had the same financial pressure early on.
You used a phrase in there that I have not heard before, learner-centered enrollment management. What does that mean?
Yeah, for me, that means that when we start thinking about class building, we have to build it in the context of student success. So when we look at how we help enable persistence, we enable student pathfinding, we enable program fit discussions and different sorts of outcomes that students are looking for. How do you build a class environment? How do you build a learning community environment that actually enables students to know what there is available for them, find the programs that are going to be the most successful for them, and access the resources that are going to help to retain them in the programs that they're looking for? So that's a different way, I think, of looking at SEM than just from an institutional needs perspective, right? This is about learner needs as well.
Maybe I'll just add to that. Like, a part of it, that sort of learner-centered approach is allowing, at least in my reflection on this, Melissa, is allowing them the ability to have a degree of agency around how they stay in a program or move to another one. And so that also, you know, shifts the ownership of some SEM decisions in relation to the institution versus a faculty level or departmental decision. If we provide our learners a greater degree of agency and choice in how they learn and what they learn.
Yep, totally.
It also speaks to, in the States, there's a lot more, I observed a lot more plug and play, easy to use student information systems and you know, ways that really are supposed to allow students to just be able to make decisions pretty quickly and pretty seamlessly about their calendar, about what courses they're in, about like being able to connect immediately online or with, you know, a service provider, getting away sort of from the model of, you know, you have to go through several phone calls and you have a piece of paper where you track your courses, to like a pretty, you know, plug and play sort of model of scheduling and course development, which is extremely challenging. It's exciting in the one hand because you'll see the interfaces and be like, boy, that seems intuitive and fun. But there's also the challenge that you need faculty to be convinced to make their courses plug and play and dynamic like that, which is a major challenge in implementing those sorts of models.
So I think what's interesting about what you guys have talked about so far is you talked about strategic enrollment management as increasingly being a whole of institution affair, right? Because it's about the way you design courses and the way you design programs and the way you integrate student support and the way that, you know, all the stuff that goes along with the retention agenda, which can be very broad. I guess my question to all of you, and I'm going to start with you, Jonathan. I'm curious what you've seen in different parts of the country and different parts of the world as you've been doing work on this subject here at HESA, is are universities any good at that? Like, sorry, I it sounds unnecessarily nasty, but whole of institution thing is maybe the hardest thing to do at university. It doesn't matter if it's enrollment or retention or anything else. It's when you have that many people in the room, how do you get them to play nicely together? And actually, for someone to, for someone or someone's to have the responsibility to get it done, because it's very fragmented, right? Jonathan, your thoughts?
Yeah, no, I think that's, I mean, I asked whether people, there anyone's any good at it. I think there are a couple, you know, institutions that are getting good at it. But the issue is that, you know, when you're talking across so many different sectors and different sort of stakeholders and different groups, et cetera, yeah, you need to develop some common language and some common respect for each other. And I'm not sure, I think that's starting to emerge. I remember talking to a registrar who's not here, who was saying one of her main missions right now is really just impressing on faculty the fact that the registrars, the schedulers, the administration folks have expertise. Like, they're not, you know, and frankly have like a body of scholarship that's emerging. So they're trying to talk a little bit more almost in a peer-to-peer way, because the issues are becoming so complex and so challenging to navigate the academic imperatives, with the administrative imperatives, with the student support imperatives. So, like, frankly, it's becoming such a complex topic that there needs to be growing recognition of the expertise of people who have to manage and do that. And a lot of them, to be honest, have increasingly advanced degrees and, you know, professional capacities. I think professors can increasingly, at least more professors who are inclined to be open to that sort of thing are more inclined to maybe listen to that. So, like, okay, look, there's some expertise around this that I think we need to take seriously. But from what I've heard, these are emerging still. This isn't, I can't think of a like one place where this is a fait accompli, but I have heard a couple examples across the country where that those conversations are emerging and becoming a little bit more, you know, collegial.
Georgia State gets a lot of credit for what it's done on retention and the way it's redone that. I've never heard it linked particularly to the front, the funnel side, as Darren puts it, the front end, but that's the closest I can think of. Melissa, Darren, have you any thoughts from you? Who does this well?
Yeah, who does this well? I mean, I want to go back to something you said, though, around like it's really hard to do this in the way in which our organizations are structured. I think it's really hard to do this in a way that is respectful to the benefits of collegial governance, but also attentive to the fact that you kind of need a higher level actor that's accountable, right? And so that's one of our biggest problems, because a lot of people can come in and try and think about doing it as a hammer. We're going to do this, and that's what you have to be. And here's the kind of class composition you're going to take, because that's the thing that helps the bottom line. And you see that in a lot of American institutions, right? I think trying to do the marriage between the benefit of really trying to bring along a collegial governance aspect to something that still needs higher level accountability is where the tension exists. I'm really encouraged. I'm going to say I'm feeling hopeful today around SIM and its evolution in Canada with some of the stuff that we're even doing at U of A right now. So we put in place, number one, the creation of my role would not have even been contemplated 6 years ago. Having somebody with the word enrollment in a higher level position at the university would not have happened 5 years ago. So that, I think, is testament to a shifting culture. But because you have to have the endorsement of the whole in order to really do those things in a way that could actually work. And we've created, introduced a new structure around enrollment management service partners that work cross faculty to try and collaborate on outcomes and have the awareness of, if we do this, how does that work for the trickle down from right inside the classroom to the student support, to the space that you need, to the different ways in which we structure programs, et cetera, and so forth. And so the fact that we actually have faculties and deans bought into using those folks for cross collaboration purposes, that's hugely shifting in terms of opening up our ability to respond quickly to issues, but also to have some prospective strategy on issues. So, I mean, I think, is anyone doing this hugely well? In pockets, yeah, and on certain issues, sure. But I think we're evolving, but I like that we're evolving with an attention to the fact that universities are structured in a particular way around collegial governance, and you can't throw that out and expect a sustained success on this.
Darren, any thoughts?
I think about how, Melissa surfaces a couple of pieces around roles and how they're positioned in, let's say, the United States in a senior leader capacity. And that's not overly common, I think, in a Canadian context, in particular in universities in Canada. And I reflect on my own institution and the leaders in our faculties who do a lot of work that's centered around STEM, that gets to STEM goals, that gets to STEM principles. And I would say the vast majority understand the connection to it. But there comes, you know, as they transition out of their roles, there comes an educational piece that they need to do to those that follow, we need to do to support them, that I think can be more deeply embedded in our culture in a Canadian context to realize, you know, as Jonathan acknowledges, that there is a body of literature that's associated with this. There are subject matter experts that are in our academy that we can pull on to help build this out. And so I think there is a benefit to not having that sort of positional leadership role in some places if there is a willingness to have a culture around it and to really embed the language in roles that in some cases we may not naturally think would be contributing to STEM, but very deeply do. You know, for example, anyone who might be at a first point of contact in any of our student spaces is someone who's a key contributor to the retention element of strategic enrollment management.
Including professors.
Correct.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. Right. Especially professors. And I would say if you were to do a broad-based poll to ask them if they even knew what the three letters meant, you may not come out on top of on very much. But when you break it down to what STEM actually means, they could most definitely see themselves within it. So how do we ensure that sort of understanding of our codified language around strategic enrollment management is understood more broadly in our institutions? That is, I think, where we'll see the greater benefit as opposed to us needing to attach ourselves to three letters.
Well, and how you make sure that we don't corporatize them. Because if STEM starts to be interpreted by folks in our campuses as if it's part of corporate culture, which we've got a lot of people highly resistant to, then it gets diminished, right? But when you frame it the way that you were talking about it, Darren, around STEM is really everybody's accountability around creating an optimal environment within which our missions thrive and get activated. Like, I know that sounds like a lot of buzzwords, but if you break it down, it's true, right? It's how we activate our learner mission is to do strategic enrollment management well, whether it's the frontline recruiter or it's the service provider in the faculty, or it's the professor in front of the classroom, right? All of that is STEM. And if STEM becomes more attached as a notion within our core business and isn't seen as in opposition and a corporatization of our business, then it has a lot more power as a common thread to allow us to have some more strategic conversations about the choices we make about access and the choices we make about our admissions practices and the choices we make about our spaces. So I think you're absolutely right there. And that's what I worry about, is that when they see it in the American context, they go straight to a corporate lens on it sometimes, even though I know a lot of our American colleagues aren't doing it in that way. And it can sometimes get dismissed, which I think is an uphill battle for us in some contexts.
Melissa, a second ago, you talked about, you were noting how the culture was shifting around integrated, you know, a more integrated approach to SEM. Why? What's pushing this?
What's the driver around it? I think folks are seeing that, well, few levels, right? One is we have to get more serious about class building from just a sustainability standpoint, right? To be responsive to the pieces of our mission that say we should have more accessibility, that our classroom should reflect our society, these sorts of pieces, right? You got to be intentional if you actually want to shift that and just not replicate the kind of class you've had for years and years and years. So I think our conversations on equity, diversity, inclusion, and accessibility have actually shifted people to want to be more intentional about these discussions. I think when we've seen internationalization and bringing more international students in, that has started to change the conversation around STEM. And there's more attention there, both to international student numbers, but also international student quality and making sure we have the right supports in place. So I think we've got that. And then, you know, to be frank, funding arrangements and the balance of where money comes from and making sure that we create a good optimal learning environment that's sustainable means we need to retain the students we recruit and means that we need to make sure that we've got a balance that can keep programs sustainable from a financial standpoint.
That's the view from Alberta. Darren, does it look the same from York?
I think in very similar ways. I would say that, I mean, the universal we has become much smarter in thinking about what it means to recruit international students. It is, I think, a deeper way of thinking about how an institution is structured, how a classroom thrives with a diversity of perspectives. And so that, I think, has changed that sort of culture shifting, because it's less of a once upon a time thinking of an avenue solely for dollars to the institution, and much more progressive present day, at least in my own space, around how does that shift the learning in the classroom? How does that bring in different perspectives? And as we think about how we structure recruitment practices, how do you actually ensure that your international student body is diverse and ideally as reflective as it possibly could be of the local area and community? I think that has helped to shift culture. It's not, I can't say that's consistent across the country, because if you look at, you know, recruitment and enrollment numbers from international students at different colleges and universities, they vary greatly. It's an observation that I have that I'm grateful for, to see that there's less of a focus on the dollars, and much more of a focus on future potential for what could happen in just, you know, providing education and access to education to groups of individuals who may be either traditionally excluded from our system can help to contribute to a diversity perspective in a classroom environment on a particular topic.
Jonathan, I'm going to flip it over to you, because Darren, you made an interesting comment there. I mean, internationalization is one of those things I think has in some ways derailed the SEM discussion, at least in some parts of Canada, because SEM is seen as being something registrars do or enrollment managers do, and internationalization is something the international VP does, or, you know what I mean, in the sense that the responsibility has sort of been that the international class is somehow seen as being apart from the domestic class, not everywhere, but in some places. And the focus has been so heavy on the, you know, as you put it, it's the dollar signs, Darren, that in some places that it sort of takes over. Jonathan, what's your sense across the country about the balance between, you know, how many of the SEM plans that we see really take internationalization, you know, seriously? I think the way that Melissa and Darren have been talking about.
I'd say most of them do. I don't know. I feel like the characterization there, I mean, is a little stark, particularly, I mean,
me, the, stark, the, is that like,
yeah, I think because like part of it, yeah, because part of it is the SEM structure is catching up to internationalization.
Yeah.
Because like there was the imperative and to get international students, you know, from 15, 20 years ago, let's say, and SEM structures in Canada have only evolved over the past 5-10. But I think maybe because of that, I'm struggling to think of a SEM plan or at least outline I've seen in Canada that doesn't at least partly think about international students and sort of supporting international students.
Of course, not everywhere has a SEM plan, right? Like, I think
that's more the thing is like there just aren't that many. Like the thing in Canada is like there still aren't that many fully articulated SEM plans, as I discovered when I was talking to a bunch of people across Canada. So like, well, yeah, we're making one, or like we're on the road to one. We have a lot of SEM principles and like ideas, but like coordinated plans are not incredibly common. So I think because of that, though, because you know, a lot of them are catching up to, you know, the conditions that are in play and the fact that international students are so essential, it's very difficult to imagine a SEM plan emerging in Canada that doesn't think about international student numbers and support pretty fairly seriously.
Interesting. Melissa, you've mentioned a couple times the term class building. And I think that's a really interesting one, because certainly the, you know, the big American discussions around SEM, at least the more flowery ones, you know, talk about crafting a class, creating a class. I think that was the title of Jeff Salingo's last book. And it was an excellent book. I mean, it just shows you, it was a fascinating book about how admissions drives so much of the activity in a university. I recommend Jeff's book to everybody, because it's an amazing way of understanding American higher education. But when he uses that term and you use that term, I think we're talking about something different. The American view of crafting a class is partly an affirmative action discussion in some places. Partly it's a financial discussion, or early admission, how much you can charge people at different times of the cycle. But also partially, it's how many athletes are we getting, and how many, the Varsity Blues scandal in part comes out of the crafting a class thing. And then there's, there was Tina Fey in that book, in that film on admissions, right? Which is, how many of them can play the clarinet? Do we have is everybody in for the band, right? Like there's really weirdly micro considerations that go on in that. I don't think that happens in Canada. I don't think that's what you mean by creating a class. So could you elaborate a little bit of what you do mean and how it's different?
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, some of the reason we don't get that granular is because we simply don't have the data to get that granular. So I think there's some of that happens. But I will say sort of I've sensed a shift from admissions and class building being about exclusion to it being about inclusion. And it feels like a bit of a moment in time shift, because institutions, particularly selective institutions, right, have been about exclusion because we've had very either small seats or we've had high demand relative to small seats. And I think we're looking at a different way of class building now in the last, 5-7 years around how do we bring a more diverse set of students in, right? And so class building becomes a situation of creating structures, financial supports, support structures once students get here to be able to steward and help be successful a more diverse set of students, right? And so class building becomes a bit of this is when I go back to activate your mission. What's the mission of your particular institution, and what kind of students help you to activate that mission and help evolve your institution forward, right? For us, we're talking about making sure we have Indigenous students that hopefully are as prevalent here as they are as part of the population in Alberta, right? So do you have a reflective population? To Darren's point around international students, can you be a globally relevant institution without a significant proportion of international students? I think it's hard to, right? I think you need to provide the diversity of opinion. Can you be a nationally relevant institution without a national voice where you have students from across the country? Harder to do. And can you be stewarding your province where you are located if you don't have a good percentage of those? So you actually do have to be attentive across a number of dimensions. And then it's also program diversity, right? So when we talk class building too, we're making sure that we are ensuring that our programs are healthy, right? And if we don't have health in those programs, what is that going to do to our ability to, again, activate what our goals and mission are? So it could be more granular if we had more data, but I really think it's around becoming more accessible and more reflective of our objectives. So I think it's getting more precise, to be honest. And I think it's getting more about bringing students in than keeping them out.
Darren, you got any thoughts?
I agree with a number of things that Melissa has said, and as either provinces or individual institutions become a bit more either open to or create pathways to collect additional data points, whether they be through like individual student census data at individual institutions, or as Melissa alluded to, as the Ontario University Application Centre is starting to collect data among its applicants to be shared with post-secondary universities, actually, specifically, there has to be like an ethical view to how we use that data to inform our admissions practices. And so that is not a really deep-seated or prevalent thing in our sector yet around it. I think there's a consciousness that we should be protective and supportive and attentive to the data and not want to have it be accessible by those that should not have access to it. But a really conscious effort as to how our ethical standards are applied when we receive that data and how it's used, I think is going to surface greatly. I think the class building conversation has a real opportunity to elevate those that have been traditionally excluded from our sector. However, those that have been traditionally excluded from the sector will question heavily, the disclosure of that data to a third party, how institutions will use it, and whether they will do so, ethically, as I was alluding to. And so there is an education piece that we will need to do with our community across the country, and globally, ultimately, around how we will enter into that world safely and supportively of our learners.
So true, Darren.
Maybe the work that the National Clearinghouse has done along some of those lines might help, at least as a press, to sort of see, like, to point a direction of where that could go. Because, I mean, I know you can definitely see how they use the data in ways that say, like, you know, here's how we are changing admissions policies, here's how we're targeting different communities, and how we're, you know, developing retention supports, et cetera, that target specific. And here are the, you know, the outcomes that we can see from that in terms of improved retention, improved recruitment, et cetera.
I'm curious from all three of you, just as a last point before we end this, like, what I want to come back to the point earlier about this being a cross university affair. What are the biggest barriers to, in effect, enthusiastic adoption of cross university initiatives like this? And do you think we'll overcome them in the next 5-10 years? Like, what are the things that need to happen from your perspective? And obviously, I'm not going to ask you about your own institutions. But, you know, you've got a pretty, I think all of you've got a pretty good sense of how these issues are playing out in large institutions across the country, at least some of you on it. What do you think? What are the big barriers? How do we get to the promised land in STEM?
So it's the easy question last then. Yes. Okay. Good. Yeah. Thanks. Yeah. Thanks. I'm glad we ended with a softball. You know, as you say that, I think one of the things that's come up even as a theme through this conversation is around education, right? And educating our campus community about STEM, but doing it in a way that we get to the WIFM, right? The what's in it for me, and how does that actually advance what I'm doing day to day? I think about that in the context of helping engage a dialogue with our professoriate. Like, why do they care what we're building as far as a class, right? Why do we care about that? I think there is the thing, they reflecting back the Darren's point, the things you're already doing that actually are STEM, right? And helping people to see the activity they're already engaged in as relevant to that objective, and how it's been important to their work in the past, and how it can be important to their work in the future. And then I think there is an opportunity, once you've got those pieces in place, to really bring things into more aggregated conversational structures that feel familiar for a new purpose. What I mean by that is feel familiar from the collegial governance standpoint, but are used for the purpose of strategic enrollment management. And you can see it not to go into committee purgatory, right? Because we're good at that, but to actually create useful collegial structures that let us do that education and also input process that can make STEM work better. And I think that a lot of our institutions right now, because of the soup we're cooking in around accessibility, around internationalization, around sustainability, have an opportunity in the next 3 to 5 years to do that well in ways that we haven't been able to before. Because I think there's a bit more of a burning ambition on some of those pieces that will let us have those cross-campus conversations differently. But this is not easy work. And if you don't start with the what's in it for the individual, I don't think you get very far.
And what happens if the money situation gets worse? I mean, I hear you. I agree with you, Melissa, but I think it depends on there being, you know, being able to play on that balance between, you know, funding and diversity. How desperately do you want to catch that next international student? You know, I think in Ontario, the thing that's worrying the heck out of me right now is if I take the two traditional sources of income, which is domestic tuition fees and government grants. Those have both been frozen by the provincial government for the last 4 years. And I'm going to guess it's going to be frozen for another 4. And by the end of that period, we're going to end up in a situation where institutions are 30% poorer from those sources. So I guess my question is, is this kind of balance a luxury, or is STEM going to get pushed back to the, hey, go find the dollars, because we're desperate for the dollars. Darren, how do you think that institutions will react in a crunch to this kind of thing?
You know, people will have the visceral, guttural reaction to what we do. I think, and maybe I just wear a lot of rose-colored glasses, but my hope is that institutions, regardless, university, college, institute, or another place of higher learning, turn back to their values that they like are trying to guide how their strategic or academic plans work, and say, how can we then shift according to these core principles that we have? Partially because if the dollars become the main focus around this, we're going to repeat a cycle that existed, you know, 60 years ago, 80 years ago. And it's going to put us in a place where our society is positioned very differently in the bigger picture. So I'm going to keep my rose-colored glasses on and hope that institutions look back at their values and think about other places that can help to shift either fill that gap, looking creatively in different spaces. I'm not going to go try and remodel the list right now, but it will turn a conversation to who is in our class, how are we recruiting students, what are we recruiting students for, which I think is actually going to be the bigger question at the end of the day, into which programs, into how they're connected to society and how they're connected to present and future day opportunities, both job opportunities, but opportunities beyond that as well. So my hope will be a return back to core values and then rethinking our approaches from that lens, from my sunshine and rainbows perspective.
Got it. Just for our listeners at home, Darren is wearing glasses, but they are not rose colored. They are fabulous.
They're just nice glasses. So, yeah. I was going to say, you know, to build on what you're saying, Darren, I mean, it's, you can make it a dichotomy, money or, you know, values driven sin, but it doesn't have to be. And I think it is often thrown up as a dichotomy. And I think that's dangerous. I think it actually is really dangerous for the future sustainability of our institutions. I think we have to be able to see that there's a way to do financial sustainability that also relies on our values and our purpose. There is. And you can see it in, you know, some institutions, which I don't think there's a perfect institution, but even look, once Michigan got through some of their scandal around some of their promotional material, University of Michigan, you know that. But I think there's a lot of thoughtful attention going into, you know, how do you create equitable structures? How we've talked with them recently, you know, and how do you do that? But how do you also make sure when only 10% of your grant is coming from your state, how are you financially sustainable? And this is going to get institutions confronted with the notion of right sizing. How do you steward your communities in the way that you need to, but how do you have a right size from programming? How do you have a right size in terms of enrollment? So that you can stay true to those values. So it's a hard questions road, but I don't think it is necessarily a dichotomy of money or class building in a more equitable way.
The Michigan example is really interesting because as I understand it, and please correct me, but they have one of the most robust education panels for mm-hmm. first gen students.
Yep.
I remember studying them quite a few times as an example of just and thinking of that, breaking that dichotomy, because it isn't just like, sure, but they're chasing some new student dollar, but they're putting a ton of effort into just explaining processes that for students who come from families with academic backgrounds are simple. For a lot of students, they are not. So that's it.
Jonathan, let me end this with you. Uh-oh. What's the, you've been looking quite a bit at different institutions around Canada, around the world. What's the most interesting thing you've seen in SEM in the last couple of years?
The most exciting thing happening in SEM over the last couple of years. You know what? I think one of the interesting things that's happening and is probably the expansion to graduate students. And this is a pretty new frontier. So if we're talking last 2 or 3 years, we're literally like in that time frame. I think the first working paper in the States came out in like 2018. And they're like, right, graduate students. Oh. They exist. And they have that really interesting relationship as both students, but also, you know, in many cases, also the educators. So they have that really complex role of, you know, being those, in many cases, those first line people who are going to get students, you know, aware of those services and supports and accesses, but they also need those services, supports and accesses. And you need graduate students who come from, you know, diverse range of families. You know, if there is an area that needs a lot of EDI attention, you know, it definitely graduate studies and graduate student populations is definitely an area, because, you know, I think we've all seen the reports about how many people who end up going through and getting the tenure track jobs are coming from the kids of people who have tenure track jobs, and that's ever growing. So I think a lot of the dynamics we were talking about in play here are just starting to be investigated at the graduate level, both as research grad degrees and professional grad degrees. So I would say that's the most, I mean, it may be exciting, because it's very, it's still nascent, it's still emerging, but I think it's probably the area to keep an eye on to see how it interacts, because it's going to be a very complex, but I think really crucial part of it.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. And thank you very much to Melissa and Darren for joining us today. Darren Fernandez, Assistant Vice Provost and University Registrar at York University. Melissa Padfield, Deputy Provost, Students and Enrollment at the University of Alberta. And Jonathan McQuarrie, Manager of Academic Planning here at Higher Education Strategy Associates. We hope you enjoyed the podcast and join us back here in a couple of weeks.
One Podcast to Start Your Day is a Higher Education Strategy Associates production, produced by Tiffany McLennan and Samantha Pufek.
Big finish!